Alrighty, guys, welcome back to the Left of Straight Show Interviews, the premier podcast that shares the stories of our amazing LGBTQ community and, of course, fantastic straight allies, all from entertainment, foodies, books, music, and advocacy. I'm your host, as always, Scott Fullerton, and let's start talking.
Hi.
Alrighty, welcome back, friends. Today, I'm thrilled to sit down in the studio with my friend David Reddish is here. He's an award-winning journalist, opinion columnist, commentator, novelist, and a dynamic voice in the entertainment industry. Currently, he writes and works as the managing editor for Entertainment for Wealth of Geeks, where he delves into the vibrant nexus of pop culture and entertainment news, all with a bit of a geeky twist. David's insightful commentary and engaging storytelling have earned him a dedicated readership, and with the recent release of his third book on the series Wrath of Comic-Con, David continues to explore the colorful and often tumultuous world of fandoms and conventions. David Reddish, welcome back to Left of Straight Show Interviews, my friend. How are you?
Hi, Scott. It's great to be here. Thank you for that lovely introduction. I'm doing fabulously well now that I'm here with you.
Well, I am so glad to hear it. We've had a couple of great conversations in the past talking about your work. You've been gracious enough to be a special correspondent, entertainment correspondent for me back in some previous work, and we were audio only. And now that we have the face for television, we have to get you back more often. That's all there is to it.
Anytime, man. Anytime. I'm happy to do it. Always happy to chat with you.
I love it. Well, we'll definitely talk about that some more. I'm excited to have you on and talk about this book. We talked about the first book back in the day, Sex, Drugs, and Superheroes. You gotta love that. Now we're into the third iteration of it. Let's go to that in just a second. But let's start with Wealth of Geeks, because that's relatively new since the last time we talked. I think you hadn't gotten that gig yet. You were kind of shopping around right in the middle of the writer's strike and director's strike and everything else that could implode in Hollywood at the time. Yeah. Talk about how Wealth of Geeks came to pass.
I mean, it was divine intervention, truly. It was an act of miraculous, godlike sort of intervention. I happened to be at the San Diego Comic-Con last year, all too appropriate to what we're about to talk about. I was down there doing some freelance work for an outlet I won't say the name of, and I interviewed J. Michael Straczynski, the creator of Babylon 5 and Sense8, famous writer for He-Man and the Masters of the Universe and the real Ghostbusters. We had a marvelous chat. And while I was there, I met another reporter named Paul Rose. And Paul and I just sort of chatted a bit informally. He watched me do my interview portion and I gave him my business card. About a week later, he emailed me and said, "I really think we need to talk. I'm reading your work. This is very impressive." And I just thought they were looking for some freelance writing. You know, and I was not in a financial situation, unfortunately, where I was going to turn anything down. So I said, "Well, absolutely, let's talk." So this was very late on a Friday night. The first thing Monday morning, very first thing in the morning, I am on Zoom with Paul. And he said, "Oh, my CEO, the CEO of Wealth of Geeks, Michael Dinich, wants to sit in as well." I said, "Okay, that's great." And we just sort of chatted a bit. And then out of nowhere, they offered me the job as managing editor for the magazine. And I was more than happy to accept it. It has been the absolute best work experience of my life. I could not ask to be working with more talented, more generous, more empathetic people, more enthusiastic people. It's a lot of responsibility, obviously. I manage a team of about 50 people, which is a lot of moving pieces. Wow. But I'm happy to say our traffic has hit all-time highs on my watch. We're starting to diversify the kinds of stories that we're doing. I'm bringing in some very important columnists, Brian Reisman, Nathan Rabin, Simon Braund, who used to be editor at Empire. They're contributing commentary and op-ed and analysis in a way that we've never really had before. They're all doing fabulous work. It's just been a fantastic experience.
That's amazing, and it's so perfectly suited for you. I mean, I, of course, found you when you were editing Queerty, but that's a lot more. I love Queerty, but it feels tabloidy to me. Okay, so it's fun. It's fun to read and everything. But you're such a great writer, and Wealth of Geeks is like this little piece of. It kind of delves into little pieces, pockets of things that I think are a lot more up your speed. And entertainment, of course, you are just the bomb at. So it seems like a good fit for you.
It's being great so far. It's a great place for people to explore their enthusiasm and their passion for everything entertainment, as well as wealth management and travel, automotive. We have all kinds of different facets to what we're doing. But entertainment's definitely my purview, and I'm happy to say that we've discovered some incredible new writers, people who had never written before, and some fabulous veterans from the business. I'm happy we can all come together to work.
That's fantastic. Well, I am a regular reader ever since you started, and we'll put the link down at the bottom because, it's a great publication. I love that.
Thank you.
Great online publication, and you have some different people doing different things. And like you said, there's more than, it's not just entertainment. It has a little bit of everything for people and kind of deep dives into some stuff. Yeah. I like it a lot, my friend.
Thank you. That's great to hear.
Let's talk about this journey now. Like you said, this is your third book in the series. You also had a Lambda Literary Award, we've talked about before in a previous podcast. But this is fiction writing started. It's a third in a series. We talked briefly about it before. Let's talk a little bit about sex, drugs, and superheroes, and the follow-up, The Conquest of the Planet of the Geeks.
Well, those are, as you said, two novels. They are the first ever novels set during the San Diego Comic-Con, insofar as I know. This is the first series that anyone has ever written about it. Sex, Drugs, and Superheroes was my first novel. It came out in, 2012. Yeah, because we just had the 10th anniversary a couple years ago. It was something I did because of another writer's strike in 2008. I knew I wasn't going to sell a screenplay. At that time, I was trying to be a writer for film and television. And so I thought, well, if everyone's on strike and I'm not going to be able to work, I should find something to do. So I decided to write a book, and that actually launched my writing career. I'm happy to say that the book found an immediate cult following. There are a lot of geeks that really wanted to see themselves reflected in literature, a lot of queer people that wanted to see themselves reflected in both literature and geek culture. That was something that had never really been explored in the mainstream, certainly. So the novel found a following, and I guess 3 years later, I wrote the sequel, Conquest of the Planet of the Geeks, which had been planned for some time. When I started writing the first book, originally it was going to be a one-off. Then a friend of mine said, no, you have to do it as a series if you want to get it published. So I said, okay, we'll make it a series. And then as I was writing some more, I really developed a love for these characters and for this world and for their relationships. And I have enormous, like a deep connection to them, obviously. So revisiting their world with a sequel felt very natural. It also allowed me to do some things with the story that I hadn't had a chance to do before. The second book is considerably darker than the first. It deals with a lot of mental illness issues and a lot of health problems and, you know, just sort of the feeling of getting older. And what if I can't count on my friends that I count on for everything? What if I can't count on them anymore? What does that mean? What does it mean if I have all this creative energy and no outlet to put it into? So what, I guess, how many years later is it? 8 years, 7 years after it ends on a very ambiguous note, the second book. I felt like it was time to come back and finish the story with the third, which wraps up the trilogy quite nicely, I would say.
Well, we just got a copy of it for me Monday. So I've read the first 30 pages. Immediately hooks you in. I love the concept of it, of the back and forth between the past, the present. We'll talk about that in a second. But I mean, I'm sure this is going to excite all your fans who love this series. But what can we say without giving too much away to expect from this latest installment?
Expect surprises. I think overall, the people that I know that have read the first two books and have come into the third one are surprised that it's a science fiction book. It's full on hardcore science fiction, as you've alluded to. It has a parallel narrative, two different narrators, one of whom is Liquin Sonos, who is the narrator of the other two books. The new narrator is also a woman named Ashlyn, which she's set 35 years in the future. And she is a very ambiguous character that has connections to these people, but it's not immediately clear how they are connected. We do know she hates Liquin, that she comes from a world where she blames Liquin for a lot of the misfortune she's had to suffer in her life. And so, you know, you're only 30 pages in. Obviously, I am going somewhere with it. But I wanted to do something. First of all, the first two books, I sort of enjoy postmodernism and metafiction. And so if you think about the first two books, which I know you've read, there are moments of quasi-science fiction where you just kind of wonder, well, is there something else happening here? And I really liked that tone. But, you know, when I decided this was going to be the last book in the series, I thought, I'm saying goodbye to these people. I want to give them their fantasy, which would be to wake up in a science fiction movie and have a wild adventure that's somehow connected to Comic-Con, which they love more than anything. So that's exactly what I decided to do. It is a science fiction novel. It is a novel that deals a lot with themes of getting older and personal choices that will have radical ramifications 5, 10, 30 years down the road for these characters. And I think, you know, the other thing that I sort of wanted to look at with it, which has since become apparent, certainly since writing the first book, is this notion of toxic fandom. That's something that has always been around. I mean, there are stories about hideous actions by Star Trek fans in the 70s and in the 80s and Star Wars right. fans, so many others, right? But that's something that with the advent of social media, we've seen this kind of toxic fandom really crystallize. And we've seen all ranges of attacks on creative people, on actors, writers, directors, movies, studio personnel that disturbed me personally. As someone that always felt like fandom was my refuge, to turn around and see this happening where, to me, it's all about, you know, fandom is about love. Why are we suddenly faced with all this hate and this anger? So I wanted to sort of look at that a little bit in the context of these characters who love fandom and who feel like it's the place where they belong. And it led me down some very interesting roads, I'll say that much.
Well said. And I love, like I said, I like the little hook technique in the front. You kind of go in the first little opening of what it's going to be about, but how is it going to get there? That's your entire story there, which I love, kind of getting a little bit of that hook in the beginning. So you kind of know what's happening, but you have no idea how it's going to get there,
yeah.
which I think is a great kind of a hook to have. Talk about now your third book. Has your writing process evolved at all from the first one? How do you see yourself maybe growing as a writer? I mean, you're such a good writer outside of this, but as an actual fiction writer, how do you think you've evolved?
That's a very interesting question. There's no question in my mind that, yes, of course I've evolved as a writer, because I think that's just how writers work. I don't know of any writer that came out of the oven fully cooked in terms of what his style was going to be or his command of language. All writers, even the greatest of writers, Shakespeare, you know, Gore Vidal, my favorite author, they all grow in different ways. And I think part of that is an approach I adopted, which is I always want to challenge myself. I never want to be sort of rote with my writing, pardon the phrasing. I never want it to be boilerplate. I never want it to be stale. I never want to be lax in it. I want to push myself. And so it was hard enough to write a book for the first time. My second novel, The Passion of Sergius and Bacchus, was a completely different genre, involved years and years of heavy research. And that was something that I purposely did because I knew it was going to challenge me as a writer. To go back and do a sequel when I did Conquest of the Planet of the Geeks, that challenged me because you always hear, you hear all these writers and directors in Hollywood talk about, oh, sequels, they're so hard. They're telling the truth, folks. It is not easy when you love these characters so much to bring them back and find original stories for them, find new challenges for them, and inflict pain on them. Because if you have no pain, if you have no conflict, there's no real drama. There's no real story to tell. There's nothing really to hang a story on. So after doing those first three, as you mentioned, my journalistic career took off, which I'm very, very lucky to have one and that I've had as much success with it as I have. But I was so committed to that for a good 6 or 7 years that I really couldn't focus on doing a novel. So the challenge, I think, with coming back to do Wrath of Comic-Con was getting back to these characters that I created when I was in my 20s. I'm now in my 40s. And trying to sort of channel who I was and how, you know, the parts of myself that they represented and the people that I knew and the life that I lived at that time that helped it all sort of coalesce. That was a big challenge. getting back to just writing prose was a challenge because journalism comes quite easy for me. And so I find prose to be much more challenging. So getting the sort of mental musculature back that I could write a narrative fiction work, that was a challenge. And the other thing, and this is another sort of cliche, but you hear everyone say, oh, the third one, the threequel is always the hardest. And there are many, many third entries in series. We don't need to list them all right now. You and your listeners, I'm sure, could probably think of a handful off the top of your heads. The third movie just sucks balls. Like, it's terrible. And there are reasons for this. And it's because you kind of get creatively bankrupt after the second one, where it's like, well, what more do I have to say about all of this? I sort of deconstructed the first one. That was my approach anyway, is I wrote the first book as this great love letter to geekdom and to Comic-Con. The second book was meant to take all of that apart and say, well, what if it fits together like this? What does that mean? And now with the third one, it's sort of taking it all apart again and putting it back together in a way that resembles the first two, but is still its own unique story. It's sort of self-contained tale for these characters. There were a lot of challenges in that. Not the least of which is that it's hard to say goodbye to characters that you love. It's hard, you know, when you're watching a movie and it's the last in the series or the last episode of a TV show. Well, when you actually have to write it on the page, it's the same feeling, especially when these characters have had a profound effect on my life.
Do you find yourself overwriting because you don't want to see it end or anything? So you end up, and then you have to edit a lot at the end, or how does that process work?
That's interesting, man. There's always, certainly looking at it now, I'm just about to record the audiobook, actually. Looking at it now, there are always questions or ideas after the fact that it's like, oh, I could have done this, or I should have said this, or I could have done it like this, and would that have worked better? The big challenge that I had with this one, I knew there were two big challenges. One being that when I wrote the first book, I immediately sat down and said, this is what the second book is, this is what the third book is, and at that time, this is what the fourth book is going to be. And the first three were always meant to be a trilogy, and the fourth one was going to be a story sort of connected to that trilogy that was set in the distant future. And two things happened. One was that I felt like the story for the second book was a little on the thin side. It works, it's fine, but I wanted it to, it should have had, I think, maybe one more subplot. It's a little too basic. I wanted to avoid that problem with the third book. So when I sat down to write it and I pulled out all my notebooks, I could find none of my notes. I had written out the full outline for what the third book was, what was going to happen to which character, how I wanted to phrase it, the different pop culture references I wanted to use in it, the song. Songs are something I like to use in my work as a sort of Greek chorus to comment on the action. They always sort of play into what's happening. I knew the song I wanted to use in the third book, but I could find none of my notes, which then created a problem because I'm going, well, what the hell am I going to do now? And I still remember the basic beats of the story. But then I think maybe because I was a little bit older, this other character that I'd already created that was going to be the center of the fourth book, she kept poking me going, hey, no, I have the story you want to tell right now. And so my solution to this was, well, what if you come along for the ride? And that is what developed the parallel narrative. That was the way I wanted to sort of push myself, doing something like The Godfather 2, where you have two main characters that sort of reflect one another and their actions comment on one another and their choices comment on each other, but they never actually meet. You know, Vito, played by Robert De Niro, never meets Michael, played by Al Pacino in that movie. So I adopted a similar approach for The Wrath of Comic-Con, which is I'm going to have these two stories, but I actually do want them to intersect at a certain point. So I won't tell you because you're not far enough along in the book to say what that is or how that works.
I don't want to spoil anything
for the audience, you know, but it was a great challenge sort of going back and forth between these two characters, which is kind of a schizoid thing anyway. As a writer, I like to be in a certain mindset when I'm writing a certain character, you know. Right. Do you want to hear a really pretentious story about this? I mean, it's absolutely, I feel guilty even
reading. I always love pretentious stories. Okay. Are you kidding me? Share with
I me. Once read, this is a hideously pretentious story, so everybody forgive me, but it's a cool one. I once read an interview in Rolling Stone where Courtney Love interviewed Stevie Nicks. And they were talking about what they do when they're writing, their own process. And Stevie explained it sort of like, you know, when she's writing or when she's performing, it's like if she's doing Goldust Woman, she kind of is the Goldust Woman. Or if she's singing Rhiannon, she kind of is Rhiannon. And Courtney talked about that a little bit too, how it's certain her songs are sort of facets of her personality. So when I write my main characters, you know, if I'm writing Liquin, I sort of become Liquin in that moment. Or if I'm writing Sergius, I sort of become Sergius in that moment. Well, in this book, I am both Liquin and I am also Ashlyn, like going back and forth between these two different characters. So that definitely pushed me in a way that I didn't expect it to, sort of going back and forth between these two mindsets that are very radically different from one another.
I love that. That is awesome, though. I'm a very fast reader, so I just haven't had time this week to read it. The 30 pages I did, like, in a quick sitting. I'm looking forward to finishing it up this weekend. And you answered a couple of my questions, because I do know, there you go. Show that dang book. We'll show it again at the end, too.
Awesome.
But you do have music featured prominently, and I do love the music references to it. It does match very well. So that was one of my big questions, is picking the music for it. And also, I mean, you're doing, this is coming from your love of the comic book. What experiences do you kind of cherish that helped get, that made it into the book? Is there anything that you remember from Comic-Con that had a little shadowing or foreshadowing or creeped into it?
Oh, sure. First, I'll answer the question about the song first, because that was possibly the most organic part of the entire process. When Sex, Drugs, and Superheroes was about to come out in 2012, I went to New York City to promote it, and I was the special guest at a big party at the Stonewall Inn. It was absolutely amazing. Fantastic. And as I was walking around the city, I was sort of obsessing over this song called The Fly, which was originally recorded by U2, but Courtney Love had covered it in a concert, which was my first exposure to it. And I just kept thinking about it. It felt so much like the book, or like the moment that I was living. You know, so much of it's about the artistic process. There's this incredible line: every artist is a cannibal, every poet is a thief, and we all make a lot of money by selling all our grief. And I really felt that. Like, I thought, what am I doing right now? Like, I'm giving people, you know, all the love and the shame and so many parts of my naked self with this novel. That really, really resonated with me. And so I just couldn't get it out of my head. And so I started doing some more reading about it. And I read that Bono said when he and The Edge wrote the song together, they envisioned it as being about a phone call from hell. Where someone is actually calling you in the middle of the night, trapped in hell, and warning you of all these things. And I thought, isn't that cool? Like, what if Liquin had a phone call from hell? Like, what if I got a phone call from hell? What would that mean? What if I was in hell and I was calling somebody? Like, what would I tell somebody? So that just sort of got the wheels turning in terms of the kind of story that I wanted to tell. And because there is this degree of finality both in the song itself and to the story, it just seemed like a great match together. Liquin's story in the book very much has to deal with his emergence as an artist and with him putting himself on display for the first time in a very vulnerable, naked kind of way. So I wrote those feelings that I had into his character. What was this? And the second part of your question was, my brain is dying. What did you ask me, Scott?
No, that's okay. The second part is your experiences in Comic-Con.
Right.
How did that kind of come into the book and from the shadowing for it?
That one's a little bit easier. I will say it's not just Comic-Con that informed this book. It was summer camp when I was in high school. It was trips that I took where I made friends on the trip, and you know, you become sort of best friends with these people over the course of the week, and then you never really see each other again, or you don't talk as much. It was Comic-Con and the many, many people and experiences I've had since writing the first book. It was also part of my college life. I did a Disney internship, which, much like Comic-Con or summer camp or any of these vacation buddies that you meet, I was with a huge number, about 20,000 other college kids, and we were all working together, and we all just grew and changed and exploded in ways that none of us really expected to. I went into that very much a kid. I came out of it much more adult. And you're the first one. You're getting the exclusive on this, Scott. So I hope you appreciate. About 10 years after this happened, I went back to Disney World, to Orlando, and met up with some of my friends, roommates and friends that I'd had, boys I used to date, all kinds of, different people. And there was one night where, for one reason or another, I had a huge emotional just explosion, like from the deepest part of myself in a way that I never had before. And I kept thinking to myself, give them what they want. I was screaming to God, give them what they want, because I love these people so much. And I love that part of my life. And I was so happy in that time. And it was such a gift to me. And so that moment really informed where Liquid and his friends are going in this story. He's having this incredible feeling of, I love these people more than anything, and they're all about to leave me. They're going to leave me behind. And I don't know that I matter to them in the same way. So I wanted to sort of explore, what does that mean for a character if he doesn't feel like he has his love reciprocated? What does it mean when you have that kind of experience with anybody of, oh, I have to face who I was 10 years ago and how I've changed and the bad choices that I made and the great choices that I made and the wisdom that I've gained. So it's about growing older, I think, in a lot of ways on that level.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, that's a very open and raw moment. So I think we've all established it in some way or another. We've kind of gone through something like that. It also kind of brings my next question. I mean, as an author and kind of the geek culture sphere, I'll call it, how do you balance catering to that audience, but then pushing yourself and pushing your creative boundaries?
I mean, that's a very interesting question, and it's one that I've had many, many conversations about with many of the filmmakers and creative minds I've interviewed in my career. And I'm of the mind that if you really know this world and you really know these characters, the fans will automatically get what they want just to be back in that world. And if you understand the history of these characters, if you understand who they are and the world that they occupy, it will fit for everybody. I think it's a mistake, and I feel this very, very strongly. I think it is a mistake to write sort of constant winking jokes or fan service or lots of sort of self-referential tidbits into a narrative, because it sort of becomes about something else then. You're not really telling a story. You're just kind of giving your fans a lap dance. And I don't want to give my fans a lap dance with my work. I want them to feel like they're making love with my work. So two very, very different feels, right? And I don't have to list the movies or the shows. You know them. Your listeners know them. The number of movies where you go to it and you just feel like, oh, this movie just wants to kiss my behind, but it has no real story to tell. It has no real reason to exist. Okay. And then you have, and this ties in with the toxic fandom, you have people that only expect that. They expect the complete validation from the movie. They expect all the jokes. They expect it to be exactly the same, exactly what they wanted, exactly what it was before. That's not how art works. That's not how creativity works. All art is of its time. And I adhere to something that Orson Welles used to say, which is, he used the example of writing an opera based on Othello. He said, you have the right, if you are Verdi, to make it a great opera, if you are Bellini, to make it a good opera, and if you're Joe Sheboygan, to make it a bad opera. But it is your opera, so you do with it what you want to do. You don't have to listen to anyone. You don't have to fulfill anyone's expectations. You do what you want with it, because that's the power of art. It's yours, and people will respond to it however they want. But here's the big secret. People will always respond, even if you're just trying to give them a lap dance. People will respond however they want or however they feel like they need to. Right. So did I worry about getting haters or thinking people wouldn't understand this story? The thought crossed my mind. There were a lot of people that didn't like the second book because it was so dark. It was a huge shock that coming off a story that was so effervescent and bright and full of love, that it would be so dark and despairing and depressing. And so now to do a third one, I wanted elements of both of those mixed in. And I think I accomplished that pretty well.
So well said. I like that. And I love the juxtaposition between the two books. So I'm really looking forward to that part of finishing reading this one. Talk about what you think maybe is your, what's the biggest misconception of Comic-Con culture, do you think?
I mean, there are so many. There are misconceptions of Comic-Con culture even within Comic-Con culture. I think one of the biggest, certainly one that was on my mind when I wrote the first book, was this misconception that geeky people, that nerdy people, are automatically socially awkward. They have no skills at all. They are unattractive people. They are sexless. They have no libido. They have no lives. They have no creativity. And nothing could be further than the truth. To go to a big convention like Comic-Con or WonderCon, I was just there a few weeks ago, you sense the pride that people have and the love that people have for this culture and for one another, the incredible respect and understanding. And I want to emphasize understanding. These people understand each other when they don't feel understood anywhere else. You know, they feel like outsiders every other day of their life, but they can go to Comic-Con and, oh my gosh, these are my people. They speak my language. I can make reference to this obscure movie or this obscure comic book or this, you know, whatever it may be, and someone will understand and someone will be able to have that conversation. Right. That is one major misconception that I think the public has in general. I find the Comic-Con subculture to be a very sexual culture, a very horny culture, but also a very, a very sexually active one. There are, and I reference it in the book, there are many, many sexual encounters that go on at the convention circuit in some very frank, sex-positive ways. And that was something that I wanted to explore in depth this time, since it was going to be the last time. And since, you know, the first two books, sex was something very much on the mind of the main characters, but I'm also not somebody that likes a lot of sex scenes in what I'm reading or what I'm watching, because most of the time they just stop the show cold, you know?
Right.
So for this one, I wanted to explore a sexual situation where you actually learn something about the characters. And I'll let you arrive at that, because it is meant to be something of a shock in the story.
I'm going to be texting you. It's like, oh my God, really? All right, there we go. I'm looking forward to that. Okay.
It's
you get
also
a late night text. There you go.
Wonderful. It's also based on a true story. And I'll leave it at that. I'll leave you to figure out how
all
that works. But yeah.
You were definitely getting a late night text. That's all there is to it. All right. Well, talk to me, being part of the community and everything, and you're so aware of it when you're doing your writing for entertainment and everything, but how do you approach writing LGBTQ characters in your book, and what importance do you place on that representation in your storytelling?
I approach them the way I would approach any other character. And I'm an equal opportunity approacher in that regard. I write my straight characters the same way I would write my queer characters. In a story like The Wrath of Comic-Con, it's so easy because as LGBTQ people, we automatically feel othered in society. Even now, you know, we're living through such a great moment of pop culture acceptance for LGBT people. But at the same time, we still get all the blowback. We still have to deal with so much of the same crap we've all had to deal with our entire lives. And we are still othered. We're constantly reminded that we're different. And that's by people inside and outside of the queer community. I've met so many queer people that want us to be different, and oh, we shouldn't try to emulate straight people at all. We should try to have our own culture and our own lives and our own family structures and our own love lives. And I don't think that's the answer any more than trying to completely adhere to straight culture either. I approach writing my characters in that same regard. I try to be equally frank and matter of fact with whether I'm writing a straight sex scene or a gay sex scene, whether I'm writing a woman or a man, whether I'm, you know, regardless of the race or the age of the character that I'm writing, I always ask, what is it that this person wants? What is this person's function in my overall story? And how do they sound? How do they feel? What are they thinking? This goes back to the idea of, well, I'm sort of Ashlyn when I'm writing Ashlyn, or I'm Liquin when I'm writing Liquin. Right. And it's interesting, the things that just sort of come up out of me as I'm writing them that I didn't necessarily intend. With the character of Ashlyn, for example, she's one of my narrators. I always thought of her as a kind of a genderqueer, non-binary character. And that was not something I'd originally envisioned. Mm. That was just something that as I was writing her, I kept thinking, this is somebody that she feels this way about her body and she looks at herself this way and she's uncomfortable with certain things, but she's very comfortable with things that most people might be uncomfortable with. Getting at that energy, it just starts as this kind of feeling, this kind of energy, and then that sort of transposes onto the page in subtle ways. I don't like to be didactic with my characters where they come out and just say, this is who I am, and this is what I think, and this is how I feel, and this is how I identify. I think that's really, really boring, and so many writers fall into that trap. I like my readers to be able to pick up on aspects of these characters and elements of them in the same way that if you were in a room full of people, you might pick up on, oh, that person maybe is a little bit slow, or that person might be a little bit smart, or that person might be a little bit wary, or that person's maybe been through some trauma, or that person might be a little bit more religious. There are always hints in our day-to-day lives, in our behaviors, that I think suggest these things. And so that's something I really try to bring to my work, certainly.
Well, you're so good at it. You're so good at starting the character, then layering on top of it. I mean, just reading what I've read, and I want to meet Reese. I may want to date Reese. I'm not 100% sure yet, 30 pages in. We'll have to see what happens. But I just like there was little elements that were added to the characters, Ashlyn's character each time, the hair, the things like that, things that were added and added little context and everything. So you do that very well, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you. I do my best.
Well, finally, as far as this writing and books go, what advice would you give to aspiring writers who wish to delve into a world of kind of geek culture or fandom? What have you kind of learned from the feedback you've gotten and just from writing that you would let other people know going into it?
Live it. Live it as best you can. Put your entire self into it, and push. I guess that's the biggest thing. For any creative person, push. Push yourself deeper, push yourself harder, push yourself to the places you're scared to go, because that's where you're going to find the biggest payoff.
So finally, David, what advice would you give to maybe an aspiring writer who wants to kind of delve into the world of geek culture and fandoms? I mean, you've got feedback now after 3 books and you've experienced the writing. What do you recommend to future writers out there?
Don't be afraid to do it. I mean, geek culture, it's overwhelming, but the beauty of it is that you can immerse yourself with it. I think everybody is a little bit of a closet geek. I know so many people that have gone to Comic-Con and just, what's it going to smell like? What are people going to look like? What are they going to be wearing? The costumes and the weird clothes and And then they say, oh my gosh, it's the Strawberry Shortcake Dream House. I had that as a kid. Oh, wow. And it awakens something in people. There's so much nostalgia and so much dreaming and imagination in con culture. I don't be afraid to put your feet in, folks. Maybe start small. You don't need to go to the San Diego Comic-Con. It's too dang crowded as it is already. But start with a smaller convention, start with something regional, and don't be afraid to give yourself over to it. Let your geek flag fly.
There you go. Great advice. I love going to the little cons around. GalaxyCon comes through Columbus every year, and Steeltown Con over in Pittsburgh. So yeah, there's a lot of small regional ones where you can really have some fun with it. Well, I appreciate you so much, David. David Reddish, the new book is Wrath of Comic-Con. Hold it up for everyone to see. There you go. It's available now. David, thanks so much for being back on the Left of Strange Show interviews. Let everyone know where they can find you on social media and your great website that you are now the entertainment managing editor for.
My website is Wealth of Geeks. That's Wealth, W-E-A-L-T-H. Yes, I'm used to typing it out, not used to spelling out loud anymore. Wealthofgeeks.com. You can find all my journalistic work there. You can find the book at Amazon and other fine retailers where fine books are sold. And in terms of following me on social media, I am the Gay Magneto, all one word, on Instagram.
There you go. David Redder, thanks so much. Stay on the line here for me. Guys, we're going to have David back. He was such a great special correspondent. We'll find some fun things for him to do throughout this year. I appreciate you tuning in every week here to Leftist Right Show interviews. Be sure to do all that, follow and like, and all the fun stuff out there. We appreciate you, and we'll talk to you next time. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Left of Straight Show. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast distributor, and please give us a 5-star rating so more listeners can find us. You can follow us on social media, and be sure to check out our website for contests and other news and information. See you next week.